Thank you for your talk. I was... Maybe I forgot, but I was wondering what the difference between concentration and mindfulness is. I know that we talked about those distinctions a bit before, but all I can remember is the differences between other things.
I mean, concentration in terms of, and particularly in terms of concentration as a translation of samadhi, it's like composure of mind, the settledness of mind, the sustained attention of the mind, and mindfulness, concentration or samadhi really requires a continuity of mindfulness, so that mindfulness is your building block of samadhi. And it's something that Ajahn Chah used to put a lot of attention on or emphasis on, in the sense that, you know, if you think you've got samadhi, but you're not mindful, you're not very mindful, you're not very clear, you're not very attentive and aware, then that's not concentration. That is something else. And so that another perspective. And mindfulness is starting to build the picture of mindfulness, this ability of the mind to be alert and present, but then reflective as well. So one of the words that is used to describe samadhi, concentration, in Nepali is ekakada, which is called one-pointedness. And one-pointedness is, to me, is not a great translation of that, but that's beside the point. I think a better translation is unification of mind, which is a good translation. So Lompa Samedo is at one point talked about this quality of samadhi or one-pointedness. And he said, but, you know, there is two different kinds of points. A point that includes and a point that excludes. So that oftentimes what we're trying to do when we make our mind one-pointed, we're trying to exclude and push stuff away, keep stuff at bay, keep the thoughts at bay, keep the memories at bay, excluding, or different feelings come. We're trying to so that we can be one-pointed. And he said, that is not really a good, it's not a solid base. Whereas a point that includes is this quality of mindful attention, mindful awareness, a mindfulness that includes and encompasses and recognizes and is not shaken by anything. And so that reflecting on these differences between concentration and mindfulness, right? It's an important reflection, because we have certain assumptions as we practice. And you know, I've got to get my act together. I've got to concentrate my mind. I've been scattered for so long. Which is true, but it's oftentimes there gets to be this sort of frantic quality where we're trying to push stuff away, and that sense of being able to be that mindfulness is able to be present and not be shaken by anything is a really important quality. Also in the sense of, you know, when we think of concentration, even in terms of its literal meaning, is when we concentrate something, we concentrate a solution, we make that solution smaller. We concentrate a sentence, we make it smaller. When we concentrate the mind, we tend to try to make it smaller. And is that really what we want? Is that really what's helpful? Because sometimes having that spacious mind is really important in terms of how that spacious awareness is really important. Not spacious in the sense of spaced out awareness, but a comfortable, stable clarity of mind that is alert and present. So those are some reflections on mindfulness and concentration.
Thank you. I feel like the point you're making about an exclusive versus inclusive unification or one-pointedness is like in line with the way that I have been practicing, because I've been taught Zazen, and that's very spacious, open awareness. And so that makes sense to me that the concentration isn't like making it smaller, but it's inclusive.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why the distinction between mindfulness and concentration is still not clear to me, because they both feel like they have the quality of open awareness that is inclusive. So I guess if I was to try to explain my understanding of the difference, it would be that concentration is a more developed kind of mindfulness, but I don't know if that's true.
So. Yeah, like samadhi is certainly is more like a fruit of mindfulness as opposed to something separate. So that the mindfulness that is able to bring samadhi to fruition. So helps bring concentration to fruition.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think this was mentioned maybe a few days ago, but I just wanted to reaffirm this. Because we're talking about memories and recollecting. If you live long enough and you start to have like Alzheimer's or dementia, if you're well practiced throughout your whole life, you'll still be grounded in something, right? You're not going to like, I don't know.
I see my memory is just not as sharp as it used to be, but I'm also aware of it. Also there's a fundamental quality, because often things, especially like, you know, as you get older, yeah, there's just a natural disinclination to trying to remember everything. There's too much to remember. It's you have to be selective, and you know, nature filters stuff out quite naturally. But also, even in terms of something more extreme like Alzheimer's or, you know, senile dementia, there's a fundamental quality of being that is not really, there's a, like I remember, one, of course, a great example is Ajahn Chah. I mean, he had, you know, all sorts of, you know, degenerative brain disease that really disabled him. I remember one time being at Spirit Rock, and a Cambodian monk who was the supreme patriarch of Cambodia, beautiful monk Mahakosananda, and we were at a meeting of kind of Buddhist leaders at Spirit Rock. His Holiness the Dalai Lama was there, and Mahakosananda was Alzheimer's was really starting to kick in, and he had shown up, but it didn't have an attendant. So the contingent from Abhayagiri, one, we noticed that, so we just really picked up the you know, attending to him, looking after him, which we would have done anyway. But then it became clear, okay, we really have to be clear on, you know, getting him there at certain times and getting doing things. But he was, despite all of that, there was no confusion there. I mean, he didn't exactly know when to be at different places and when was daytime, when was nighttime. Because he'd sometimes, you know, he'd wake up and, oh, I'm hungry. and it could, you know, it could be any time. But anyway, we looked at, but he was just a delight to be around, and he was incredibly bright. And then his interactions with His Holiness were really charming. And they were, you know, the both of these great beings just kind of beaming because they'd known each other over many years. And so it was really, you know, quite touching to see. And I remember sort of saying to another monk, when I'm old and decrepit and sitting in my wheelchair drooling, I hope I'm like that.
Yeah, just, you know, in line with what Lumpa was relating, kind of also to me it highlights the fact that there's two words, two different Pali words that are both translated, often both translated into English as mind. So when you're talking about the word mind, and particularly like in something like Alzheimer's, where there's a deterioration of what we call mind, that's actually probably more related to the term manas, which is translated as mind, rather than the term citta, which is also translated as mind, but have two kind of distinct qualities, or two different qualities. And the manas is more, I think Ajahn Jeff translates it as intellect, and it refers to those kind of, you know, functional aspects, you know, like being able to think and process and make judgments and process information and store information and retrieve information and analyze and things like that, those cognitive abilities. And citta just is a broader, more receptive term with kind of the fundamental quality of awareness, you know, being at the base of this activity of citta. It's not really a thing. It's an you know, kind of a activity when it's in movement, and it's quiet and solid and reflective when it's still, citta. And from what I've heard in the descriptions of Ajahn Chah, yeah, maybe the intellect, the manas, was really deteriorating. His cognitive functions weren't, he wasn't processing and being able to communicate and, you know, have a strong intellect kind of a thing happening. But his citta, the heart mind was rock solid, stable, and unwavering, from the descriptions. And I guess one of the monks who was able to kind of see.
Yeah, it was a close disciple of Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Sal. Actually, he was a primary disciple of Ajahn Sal. And then and then he was a disciple of Ajahn Mun as well. So I got to know him over the years, and he came to stay at Wat Nanachar. So the early days of Ajahn Chah being ill, and so he wanted to go over and visit Ajahn Chah and just sort of check Ajahn Chah out, how he could. And this monk was known for his psychic powers. His power of his meditation, and he anyway, he went over and visited Ajahn Chah, and he himself went into meditation, kind of checked out Ajahn Chah's mind, and came back, and he said, "You guys don't have to worry about Ajahn Chah. His mind is so bright and pure. You need to worry about yourselves more." But he said, but his mind likes to reflect on dependent origination. You should chant the dependent origination for him so that he can hear it. And so that was when I started. It was probably a year or so after Ajahn Chah was first bedridden. And then I started taking the Wat Nanachat community over to Wat Bapong every week and chanting Purita's form, which is of course familiar, and there's different teachings and different blessing chants. And then chanting the Vipassana Bhumi, which is a chant that is the basis of insight, all the different bases of insight, and chant that for Ajahn Chah. We started doing that every week, go over and chant and meditate, pay respects. And over time, then people were coming from all over to join us. It's a lovely sort of thing to do.
Yeah, I like to think of it sometimes, because sometimes people get very wrapped up in thinking, oh, well, you know, I know my body's going to deteriorate and fall apart, but, you know, I don't want my mind to, you know, that's the one thing I worry about. I want to have all of my faculties, my mental faculties together. And it's, I think the more you can regard that aspect of mind, the intellect, it's just like another sense base. You know, it's just like your vision is probably going to go, hearing probably going to go, you know. Well, you know, mind's another sense base, but that's not who you are.
So this is for whomever. There can be a lot of, or I was wondering how you deal with or have dealt with the fear of the renunciation and sacrifice that you have to do to, or you can do on the path of practice, giving things up that are familiar and comfortable, or even that you know are uncomfortable, but there's still that dukkha around it, or after you've given it up, the mind can proliferate on these subjects a lot. Was that, you know, what's your experience been like?
Well, I mean, you know, basically all you're really doing is giving up suffering. So it's if you see it clearly, it's pretty simple. But, you know, even suffering, to give it up, you know, because we identify with it. And so if I'm not doing that, if I don't have those thoughts, if I don't have those feelings, if I don't have that attachment, who am I? So it's a very important reflection, because on a very kind of straight level, the only thing we actually give up is suffering. So it's something to delight in, but that isn't how. Can't remember the writer who wrote. Anyway, but she was something she wrote. It was sort of, all that I ever gave up had claw marks on it. the fear of giving up anything. But it's just being able to look at that and sort of say, okay, if I were really able to give this up, at the heart would be so at ease. So it's just encouraging oneself, not trying to bash oneself into relinquishing anything, but it's sort of recognizing that, or recognizing the dukkha.
I was just going to say that it reminded me of a story from Nana Chat. You said when one of the Anagarkas was sweeping, and the lay guest said, you know, oh my gosh, there's so many leaves here. Like, how am I gonna just deal with all this? I mean, do we really have to sweep all these leaves? And the Anagarka just said, no, just the ones in front of you. So, I mean, in front of your broom, yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's also like, it is daunting if you actually think of all the things that are required to give up when you think about arahantship. But just kind of thinking about what's in front of your broom is a bit easier. You know, it's like you see something you want to eat, and you just say, can I give that up today? You know, that thing, because I'm watching this desire build up, and or a smaller amount, or you know, whatever, or you want to say something to somebody, and you kind of you see that you really feel you have to say it, because you know, if you don't say it, you're going to really regret not saying it, and then you somehow bring that up to, you know, bring up that enough energy and kind of wisdom and sense, like, okay, I didn't say it. And then you reflect later, as Ajahn Kantiko was talking about, like, what was the result of that? Because I really believed I had to say it. And then you don't. And there's a joy that arises out of that. So it's, as Lumpur is saying, is the giving up of suffering actually does, when we recognize it, bring up joy. And that's something we don't always recognize, because we sometimes just hold on to them and say, no, I'm not going to give this one up. And I think that's, you know, a lot of the metaphor, maybe was it Lumpur Cha, Pasen said, like, 80% of the time, you know, you know you should give it up, but only 20% of the time you can. It's that sense that, like, even when we know things are not helpful for us, most of the time we just, well, I'm not going to let go of that one. And so just being forgiving, you know, kind of ourselves and that aspect and open to, like, it being difficult. You know, it's simple. You just give something up, but then simple doesn't mean it's not difficult. So that's just our aspect. And another thing to point out is it's correct. Like, if it's difficult and painful, because it's our desire. It's like the Buddha is saying, this is what's causing our suffering. And so, you know, there can be something in the monastery every day. It's like, why can't I get this? Or why can't I do it that way? Why do they do it this way? Why did Ajahn Chah say I can't do that? What a jerk. And it's like, well, maybe, but also maybe if you're suffering, who's responsible for that suffering? Each of us is responsible for that suffering. So it doesn't mean the other person doesn't have karma if they're involved, but we're all responsible for that. So then when we actually step into that responsibility and we give something up, we say, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to let my mind go into that, you know, agitation and regurgitation of this. Then all of a sudden it buoys itself. It kind of feels lighter and happier. And then we see, like, oh, that's that reflection again. Like, oh, this is what happens. This is a result of this wholesome giving up. So that's just, I think, something to reflect upon because it's hard, it's really hard to give up attachments, but it's also important that we keep reflecting when we do, because if we don't do the reflection to see even that it's hard, then we kind of miss out a bit. So it's that kind of right thinking, I think.
But the other thing that just came to mind as you were talking, an Ajahn Sumedho story, and I'm pretty sure this one did come from him, was an experience he had early on alms round, when there was a young child held by his mother who was trying to decide whether to put his piece of candy or whatever it was into Ajahn Sumedho's bowl, and he would reach and then he'd pull it back and he wasn't ready to give it up, you know, this piece of candy, and then Ajahn Sumedho would stand there and then the young kid would kind of start to go over there, and the mother would encourage, and he'd pull it back. You know, he did this a few times, and finally he reached to the alms bowl and dropped it in. And as soon as he dropped it in, he apparently squealed this squeal of joy, you know, absolute joy at being able to give something that he really wanted himself. And to me, that's sort of like, you know, it's sort of like, it's hard to do. You know, you don't really want to let go of it, but when you do, you know, what bliss.